And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good evening, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. I am reporting live from Washington, D.C., well, you know, as I usually do. But now I'm in the heart of the city, in the heart surrounded by more greens than you can shake a fist at. I don't know, I've seen so many environmentalists in one room. Usually environmentalists don't even get in a room. They're usually out in some forest somewhere. So this is a very huge gathering of people from all across the nation, all focused on green jobs. I believe it may be the largest green jobs conference that's ever been held. I'm not sure about that. I'm going to ask my guest. Maybe he'll know the answer. My guest today, by the way, is very, very important, not just to, well, to the horn, but also to West Virginia and to trying to make the case that old technologies, old fossil fuels, old sources of energy are not our future, and they don't even make sense. One of the fascinating things is that environmentalists obviously know and show that the that wind and other renewable energies are better for our environment. That, I guess that goes without saying. Everyone sort of knows that. But what Coal River Mountain Watch is proving is that it's better for our economy, too. That even if you didn't give a damn about the environment, and every person in this entire hotel does today, that even then, if you just look at it as a matter of jobs or profits or local taxes, actually wind beats coal. And to make that argument, I've invited Rory McElmoyle here. He's been with Coal River Mountain Watch for a year now. And Rory, welcome to the Inside Scoop. Hang on a second, Rory. Bob, I'm not sure I'm hearing Rory's microphone.
Now you will.
All right, you're right. I do hear him now. Go ahead, Rory. Tell me again what you were just saying.
Okay. Well, thanks for having us. Thanks for having me on the show. Like you said, I work with the Coal River Mountain Wind Project, which is a campaign based in southern West Virginia through Coal River Mountain Watch. And Coal River Mountain Watch is a community-based organization based out of Whitesville, West Virginia, whose mission is to bring an end to mountaintop removal coal mining while also starting to develop sustainable economic alternatives. And so that's where our Coal River Mountain Wind project fits in. And it's really an honor to be here at this conference and be able to talk with other great environmental and economic minds from around the country to sort of change the system so that projects like ours can come to fruition and old fossil fuels and especially destructive methods of coal mining can be rendered economically illogical. So
right. Well, let me ask you this. One of the things that I learned is I read through literature, and I guess maybe I should have known this. I apologize. I'm not from West Virginia. But there actually is a Coal River Mountain that you're watching.
Yes.
I mean, it's not just sort of a name. You know, when I hear Coal River Mountain, it sounds like, there's coal and there's river. What is Coal River? What is the Coal River Mountain? Why is it called that?
Well, it's called that. I'm sure it's been called that for a long time. A lot of locals don't really refer to the whole mountain as Coal River Mountain, but on geologic maps, that's the name of it. And it's a very expansive mountain. The whole mountain comprises probably about 30 to 40 linear miles of ridgeline. And it's surrounded by some of the most beautiful communities and most beautiful valleys that I've seen in all of southern West Virginia. And so for local folks know certain parts of the mountain, like Risson's Knob or Low Gap or, you know, other places like that, and they've never really thought about it. Many haven't thought about it as a whole mountain.
Did it once have a river of coal or something?
No. No, I mean, I really couldn't tell you the history of why it was named that way.
No, what's interesting is that even in a mountain that's named for coal.
Well, actually, it is. So there's the Coal River runs through southern West Virginia, and it's one of the bigger rivers. It runs into from there into the Kanawha, which runs into the Ohio. And so it is. I mean, it's basically the Coal River flanks the mountains. I'm sure that's why it's called Coal River Mountain, actually. And the Coal River is so named because it's one of the most historically mined areas for coal in all of Central Appalachia.
That makes sense. I'm curious to know. Bob, am I being heard okay? Is my sound coming through? Because it's all right. Great. Coal River, how clean is Coal River? I mean, when I think of Coal River, I think of a river full of, you know, coal.
Right. Well, the Coal River is actually, it's heavily contaminated. It can't even hold fish populations like it used to. Really? The trout that used to run up there are all gone. They have to actually stock fish for the locals to fish in, just to, you know, have that activity to do. It's filled with, it's worse than it used to be, because before it was just underground mining in the area, mainly up until the 70s, when they just started doing small strip mining, which they call contour mining, which just, they just cut out a cut around the contour mountain and then mine the coal that way. But now, of course, they're blowing up mountains, so you have higher levels of sediment, a lot more releases from runoff from the valley fills, which is basically when they blow up the mountain, they take the soil and the rocks and the trees and they dump it into the valleys below. And that runoff has a lot of toxic heavy metals and other elements that were locked up in the coal that aren't good for environmental sustainability or human health. So.
Now, what's interesting is that, you know, when you think of a mountaintop stream, you think normally of the cleanest water on earth.
Right.
I mean, you know, you go and you buy a bottle of water, and they always tell you it's from the mountains because you don't want to have it down you know, near the end, near mm-hmm. the port, where all the sludge and so forth from all the different areas. The cleanest areas is up in the mountains. Not true with Coal River.
No, that's right. And actually, it used to be. I mean, before coal really started polluting the area, coal is actually a filtration. It serves as a filtration system. So the water coming out of these mountains, when it's in place, it serves as a filtration system, and it's only when it's disturbed and mined and the water starts mixing in with the oxidized chemicals that were locked in the coal does it become poisonous. And so it used to be some of the cleanest water that you could find around anywhere.
So I'm curious, when you get your drinking water in your county, do you get it out of the Coal River? Do you have to then filtrate all those sediments and everything out of it again? Where do you get your water?
Well, we're lucky enough to actually get water piped into us. But most of, and that's only because we live in sort of a small pocket where that happens. Most folks up and down the Coal River Valley actually still use groundwater. And a lot of their those water resources have been now contaminated due to, like, what the coal company does now is they'll clean the coal before they ship it to a power plant. And there's a lot of chemicals involved in that process. And what happens is you get this toxic coal slurry that has all sorts of toxic heavy metals, mercury, arsenic, selenium, all sorts of things. And then they either put that into huge earthen dams or they inject it into abandoned underground mines. So that pollutes people's water because that gets into the groundwater. And they never show with certainty that it's not going to get into the groundwater, and it always does. It's without fail. And
so here you have a place that used to have some of the cleanest water in the country,
now has some of the worst
water. And the people who have the cleanest in that county would be people like you who have it piped in from somewhere else.
Basically. Well, even that water is not very clean, but it's not nearly as dirty as what other folks have to live with.
Now, how long? I mean, coal's been mined in West Virginia since the 1800s, right?
Yep.
Okay, so a very long time. And the way it used to be done, at least way back then, and up until what, the 1970s, virtually all coal mining was underground mines?
Yeah, it was 90-something percent of coal mining was underground mines. It was around the 60s and 70s where they first started using small forms of surface mining, like contour mining, which even back then folks rebelled against. I mean, you had locally driven protests and activist movements. And
what is contour mining? You hack into a mine? You hack into the side of a hill?
Basically like taking a strip around the contour. You leave the peak alone, and you just cut a strip around the contour, and then they drill holes into the coal seam. So they create like a bench, an L-shaped bench around the contour of the mountain, and then they drill in and pull the coal out by auger mining is what they call it. And that was so destructive that people rebelled against it back in the 70s because they loved it. I mean, they loved their mountains. It was very intrusive for their way of life.
I assume that people who want to live in the mountains often like mountains.
Yeah, yeah.
they don't usually hate mountains and trees and fresh air and fresh water. People who want to live in the country.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's why they're called mountaineers, and they take very, very strong pride in that. They have a long history there. So.
So now the people rebelled against it, but the companies just went for it.
Well, that led to the passage of the Surface Mine and Reclamation Act, Surface Mine Control and Reclamation Act, back in 1977, and that was a product of Jimmy Carter and even you know the whole social movement against surface mining, against contour mining. But what that did, that act failed to regulate mountaintop removal. It basically codified mountaintop removal and allowed it to happen with certain restrictions and certain.
So the act said you can't dig around the mountain, but you can blow the whole thing up.
Well, it just didn't restrict mountaintop removal because mountaintop removal was not very prominent back then, and.
Mountaintop removal. I don't know. To me, even that sounds a little too calm. I mean, you could call it. It's what, exploding a mountain? I mean, what is mountaintop removal?
I mean, you could call it. You could call it the complete
bombing the mountain.
Bombing the mountains.
Yeah.
Right? A war on Appalachia.
Mountain bombing.
Yeah.
Don't you think that's a better term than mountaintop removal? Mountaintop removal
Indeed.
Sounds so quaint. I don't know. It kind of imagines like you pick up the top of a teacup and you look underneath and grab and put it back.
Right.
Why not call it mountain, I don't know, explosions, mountain bombing?
Well, I mean, people always do. You know, mountaintop removal is a general term. Other
mountain
like,
dynamiting. I mean,
mountain
is it
dynamiting.
Dynamite? Is that what they use normally?
They do. They use a mixture of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil. And,
they literally blow the whole thing up.
Right. They one piece by one piece. The first thing they do is they'll clear cut the forest that's up there. And this is some of the most highly biodiverse forest in the world. And it's a temperate rainforest. And so they clear cut that. Oftentimes they either just dump the trees in the valleys or they burn it on site. Most of the trees up there have been extensively logged over time. And so it's not commercially, I guess, profitable for a timber company to come in. And then they'll scrape off the soil. They'll take that and they'll dump that into the valleys below. And then they'll blast the rock one layer by one layer to expose the seams of coal on that are underneath. And sometimes it'll be hundreds of feet of rock and underneath that's above that coal, and all of that goes into the valleys. So
I see you're waving at someone. You're free to do that.
There's a fellow right here that came down and did some great work down with us.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, maybe he should join in. Do you want to be interviewed as well? Or okay.
Yeah, you should bring him on afterward. He was doing some great work. He came down and joined us for about a week. So.
Okay. But, all right. Well, yeah. That's good. I'll tell you. If you'll stick around, we'll put you on the air as well.
He definitely has a great perspective to add. So.
Okay. Stick around a little bit, will you?
Cool.
Okay.
So yeah. I mean, basically, it's just coal seam by coal seam. They're going after thinner seams of coal. It's the cheapest and therefore most profitable way for the coal companies to make their money.
Now, the coal companies own this land, or some of it public land, or where's the land come from?
Sometimes the coal companies own the land. Sometimes they just own the minerals. Sometimes they own neither, and there's an absentee land holding company. Most of West Virginia's mineral rights and service rights are owned by land and mineral owning companies that are based in Pennsylvania or Missouri or other places.
They bought them, what, 100 years ago and just sold them?
It's sort of been, so yeah, there was a big land grab I guess prospectors and speculators first realized that Appalachia was rich in resources, and they took advantage of the fact that people in Appalachia didn't have this legal idea of, you know, like ownership of the land. They lived off a communal system. And
that reminds you of the Native Americans that sold Manhattan for $24 in beads.
Right.
It's sort of the same idea.
Exactly.
At that time, the Native Americans didn't understand the concept of selling land, because how could you sell land? You can't sell the air or the sun or the water or the wind, so how can you sell land?
And then, I mean, you know, the folks just didn't foresee what was about to happen. And even when they did, these land companies came in and falsified records or... You know,
but if they own the minerals but they don't own the land, how the heck can they blow up the mountain?
Well, it depends on who owns the service. Sometimes they'll buy those service rights. They'll pay like an individual landowner, or sometimes like there's a land holding company that owns the service, right? So they have to lease the service rights or something like that. But
and Coal River Mountain, who owns that now?
There's two land owning companies. One is Roland Land Company. They're based out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Another one is Western Pocahontas, who is now named the Natural Resource Partners. And
Nice. Name someone who blows up the environment, Natural Resource Partners,
right.
And that's a nice Orwellian name.
Got
a nice ring to it.
And they're one of the worst. They're one of the worst around there. So.
The worst in terms of pollution?
Just in terms of an aggressive takeover of land and minerals and not caring about the impact of their... land use decisions on local communities.
But, Roy, you know the argument. And frankly, it's the argument that you hear all the time from West Virginia politicians. And that is, okay, yeah, so coal ruins the environment and ruins our water and ruins our air and so forth. But jobs, man, people are poor in West Virginia. A lot of people have jobs in the coal industry. So we pollute our lands. What can I say? At least people are getting food to feed their families. How do you address that argument?
Well, before they started destroying mountains, they had a little bit more of an argument because what they do now, and it, There's a lot of issues with underground mining. But Mountaintop Removal is so exponentially worse, you know, that it has to be stopped for a lot of reasons. And so our counter-argument in terms of the Mountaintop Removal issue is that your job is not worth my life. Your job is not worth my property. Your job is not worth the health of my kids, you know, or my unborn child or my parents' health, you know. So, and that's really where it comes down to.
Are there more jobs in the old underground mining or more jobs in exploding these mountains?
Bottom? There's actually the surface mining has led to a rapid decline in coal-related employment across Central Appalachia, mainly because it's more highly mechanized. You can, per ton of coal produced, and this used to be a more stark contrast, but per ton of coal produced, with surface mining, for that same ton of coal, if you mine it underground, you produce two jobs, whereas with the surface mining, you just produce one.
Okay, so already jobs are halved. Jobs are halved, totally apart from the environmental impact. The jobs are halved just by the fact that they're blowing up the mountain rather than digging into it and getting stuff underneath.
Right, exactly.
Now, you, or your organization, I should say, has put forward a very nice little glossy thing that I have in front of me, December 08, so it is timely, mm-hmm. that compares the cost and the profit, and both in terms of dollars and in terms of electricity, of mountaintop removal, of mountain bombing. I might just call it mountain bombing. That just seems a lot more accurate to me than removal, because removal.
I mean, you're not lying.
Okay, so the difference between mountain bombing and wind production.
Uh-huh.
Now, how much wind can be produced in West Virginia? Are there wind farms in West Virginia?
Yeah, there are. There's actually currently, within a few months, there will be a total of 330 megawatts of wind, which is enough to power approximately 70 to 100,000 homes. Depending on consumption.
Already, right now in West Virginia.
Right.
You can power 70 to 100,000 homes.
Yes. Yeah. So those wind farms, well, 230 megawatts exist right now, and then there's another 100 that's just about to be completed construction. So once that happens, then that wind power could power 70 to 100,000 homes in terms of the amount of energy that it would actually produce over the course of the year when you take into account that the wind doesn't blow all the time. Right. So.
Now, how long have those wind farms been in West Virginia?
The first one came online, I believe, sometime 2003 to 2005.
So, like 5 years ago. I mean, this is brand new stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And already it can power 70 to 100,000 homes.
Yeah, and there was already a study showing that West Virginia has nearly 4,000 megawatts of wind potential. And that study was done 7 years ago. And the technology for modeling wind potential is so much better now. And so, I expect that there's well above 7,000 megawatts of wind potential in West Virginia.
One of the things I noticed in your nice little glossy thing here. By the way, I assume people can get this somewhere, like on your website, or they can download a PDF or something?
Yeah, let me read it for everybody. So,
sure.
It's called, one of the main strategies of our campaign to get a wind farm on Culver Mountain as an alternative to a 10-square-mile mountaintop removal mining site was to get an economic study done that would analyze, that would compare the economic costs and benefits of the two options, wind and mountaintop removal. And so we commissioned a group called Downstream Strategies out of Morgantown, and they made a report for us. They produced a report for us called The Long-Term Economic Benefits of Wind versus Mountaintop Removal Coal on Culver Mountain, West Virginia. And we have that should be available on their site, which is downstreamstrategies.com. But you can definitely download it from our website, our campaign website, which is coalriverwind.org.
Well, here's what I found that I thought was very interesting. I was just looking at your map of the United States, and it shows areas where there's a lot of good wind potential mm-hmm. and areas where there isn't a lot of good wind potential. And obviously, there's very good wind potential in where you might expect the Great Plains, where you've got, you know, vast plains
yep.
where wind can blow and so forth. But what's interesting to me is if you look at the South, the Southeast, mm-hmm. that's some of the poorest wind potential in the country,
mm-hmm.
just from this map. You can see this big white fog, with the exception of Appalachia.
Right.
Appalachia, there's like a little line drawn down Appalachia, down through West Virginia, down through the heart of eastern Tennessee, western North Carolina, where it's almost like a river in a desert,
mm-hmm.
you know? Or I think of the Nile River in the Sahara Desert, where it's so important, not just because it's a big river, but because it's the middle of desert. You have wind potential in Appalachia that you don't have anywhere around it
except for
hundreds of miles.
Yep.
Why do you think this potential hasn't, I mean, it's only been around for 5 years. Is it the technology that's new, or the will, or the drive? Why is it only now? I mean, windmills have been around since Holland. I don't know how many hundreds, of, probably 1,000 years there. Why is it only now starting in West Virginia?
Well, the East Coast has been way behind in terms of moving forward in sort of energy production and progressing toward a more environmentally friendly and more climate-friendly form of energy production.
Is it a political decision? Is it a technological thing?
There's a lot of political. Yeah, I mean, you know, take a look at West Virginia, eastern Kentucky, eastern Tennessee, and southwest Virginia. That's where a lot of that central Appalachian wind potential is. For example, West Virginia has known since 2002 how much wind potential they had and how much wind potential was in the southern part of their state where all the mountaintop removal mining happens. And they didn't even put that information out to the public for 5 years. So, I mean, that right there was a big political just suppressing that information. And
is wind technology much better than it used to be?
It is. It's advancing all the time. Like, just between when we first looked at this in 2007, we were using 1.5 megawatt wind turbines as the model because at the time that was the best one for this type of location. And within 6 months, all of a sudden, we were able to use a 2 megawatt wind turbine. Gamesa Energy produces one.
It increased by one-third in half a year.
Oh, yeah.
So that would mean that in 5 years you could triple,
well,
four times.
Probably not that fast, but I mean, there was definitely a nice little boom there, and the technology is getting a lot better. The turbines are becoming more efficient. You don't want to put onshore turbines much bigger than a 2 to 2.5 or maybe a 3 megawatt in the plains, because then they just become really big monsters. You know, once you get that big, you want to put them offshore, and that's one thing we're not doing is not using enough of the offshore wind potential. Right now, so when we should be.
Let me ask you this, because I want you to sort of, people don't have the report in front of them the way that you and I do. But one of the fascinating things I found about this report is it's not an environmental report. This
right.
is not a report that says wind's so much cleaner than coal. That goes without saying. Wind is, of course, clean, and coal is, of course, dirty.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the argument you're making, how clean the water would be and how nice the environment would look. Your argument is purely based on economics,
yep.
purely based on jobs. Maybe you could use the report and let me know. Compare for me the jobs. I started to hand Rory the report. You don't need a silly report.
No,
he knows it by heart. So tell me this. In terms of jobs, just in terms of pure economics, obviously we're in the greatest downturn since the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
How is wind better than coal?
Well, so first and foremost, underground mining, like I said, produces twice as many jobs per ton of coal. So one thing that this report analyzed was a multiple use strategy for the mountain, because the purpose of Coal Mountain is to transition the region away from coal, especially by ending mountaintop removal, so that there will be jobs.
I wish I could
benefit.
Get you to just call it mountain bombing.
I've decided that's
the best way to call it. First of all, it's more accurate.
Yeah.
Second of all, it just seems, you know, it draws the senses more to exactly what's going on.
Okay, I'll try it.
Just keep saying mountain bombing.
Let's
start right here. Let's start calling it what it is.
All right, so let's say we're trying to transition away from mountain bombing.
Right.
Also, Raleigh County coal is running out in all of Appalachia. The quality of the coal has been declining, which means we're producing more per kilowatt hour produced. And at the same time, you can't find a 5-foot coal seam in southern West Virginia anymore, whereas before you had 12-foot coal seams, right? And everybody knows the coal's running out. They're just ignoring it. And they're just trying to hype up the coal industry as much as they can and support that industry. But so what this report did was it analyzed a multiple-use strategy. It looked at an expansion of underground mining within the permit boundary and a wind farm, which we found that technically you can do. Compared that to the mountain bombing situation, and it found
that you did a pure wind, I guess, would be the third option, right?
Well, no, I mean, the whole thing is a comparison. But, yeah, it does look at just wind versus MTR and the wind farm by itself. So we're looking at two scenarios. One is where it's just a wind farm built on coal.
You got three possibilities. You got mountain bombing, you got underground mining plus wind, and then you have wind alone. Those are the three.
Well, yeah, but I mean, we always, you know, the underground mining, the additional benefits, there would be 78 new jobs with the underground mining. But just looking at the wind versus mountaintop removal, right, just that direct comparison, we looked at two wind scenarios. One, or downstream strategies did. One was just the development of wind farm, what those economic benefits would be. And the other was, if southern West Virginia were to support the development of a wind industry and, say, a wind manufacturing plant was sited in Raleigh County, what would those benefits really then look like, and how would the county benefit? How would Southern West Virginia benefit, and how did that compare to mountain bombing?
Well, I think maybe the best way to compare it would be, you know, versus energy produced, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, to see how many homes it would light. I mean, that way you're comparing apples to apples.
Well, sort of. I mean, but that's, and we'll get into that. But first and foremost was the economic argument.
Okay,
I will talk about the energy issue. But in terms of jobs, the wind farm would produce less direct jobs than the three mountaintop removal operations. But over, I believe it was 28 years, the study found the cumulative number of jobs with the wind farm would exceed those of the mountaintop removal operations.
Because eventually you'd run out of mountain.
Right. And the mining plan is only for 17 years, and then the mountain would be destroyed. 9 miles of streams would be buried. The community would be devastated. You probably have a lot of excessive flooding. I mean, all sorts of consequences are going to happen in association with the mountain bombing on Cold River Mountain. But then when you look at, well, if Raleigh County were to support our campaign and say we're not going to allow mountaintop removal on this operation, we're going to support a wind farmer, we're going to pass a resolution and get the governor to back us, then you would then start to create a momentum in Southern West Virginia where, because mountaintop removal is destroying that wind potential, because what it does, it reduces the ridge altitude, and then
you can't build the whole purpose of building a windmill on top of a mountain is it's got a valley around it, so there's a lot more wind.
Exactly.
I mean, all of us know, you stand at the top of a mountain, you feel a very sharp wind. You're down in the valley, you don't feel much of a wind.
That's the basic
mechanics there.
No, that's true.
I mean, you know, you stand out in the field, you feel a wind. You stand in the middle of Manhattan between two buildings, unless there's a wind tunnel effect, basically. So actually, what's fascinating when you think about it is that mountain bombing doesn't just destroy the mountain. It actually destroys the potential of future energy through wind.
Yep, that's true. Exactly. I mean, for 17, what the governor and the county so far have seemed willing to do is to sacrifice the future economic vitality of this area, future economic potential for the area, for only 17 years of coal.
Yeah, they're saying, well, you know, for 17 years we'll give you good, and after that, you know, you're on your own. I mean,
right.
Forever. I mean, you have no chance. Basically, you should just desert West Virginia and leave, because then you won't have the beautiful mountains that you moved there in the first place to enjoy. Mm-hmm. You won't have any power. You won't have any jobs. You won't have any energy for 17 years. Of the deal with the devil, if you will, and then that's it. Bye-bye communities, go away. It could be like those abandoned western ghost towns, mining towns of earlier years.
Yep, and that perfectly illustrates the conflict that's going on right now, because as the study showed, in terms of county tax revenue, the wind farm would bring the county, on average, perpetually, forever, $1.74 million a year in property tax revenues. The mountaintop removal scenario, when Raleigh County received its share of the severance taxes coming from the blowing up of Cold River Mountain, the county would only get $36,000 a year.
Wait.
Right.
That's an extraordinary difference.
It's a factor of 50.
$1.7 million a year.
Yep.
You're not talking about over the course of 20 years.
No.
$1.7 million a year.
Per year.
And now you're telling me that in property taxes, they get $36,000 a year.
That's coal severance taxes.
From the coal.
From the coal.
Times 17 years, I'm going to do a little bit of math in my head, and I come down to about maybe $600,000, $700,000.
Somewhere around there.
What I think you're saying is, for the entire life of coal, they're going to pay less than one-third of what the wind people will pay in 1 year?
Yep, exactly.
That's extraordinary.
Well, see, and there you go. So this builds up to the fact that the conflict is between that the wind farm is better for the public. It's better for the local communities because they don't have to deal with the social and environmental externalities of the coal production, which aren't included in the cost of coal. And then they also have jobs and tax revenue, which that extra tax revenue could be used to stimulate new economic development. And that's the beautiful thing about wind power across the country that's being developed in rural areas, is it's a much better economic boon for that area than any resource extraction has ever been.
Okay, so part of the problem is, and this was the problem, frankly, when we went from horses to cars, right? All those blacksmiths, they lost their job, right? When you change technology, people have to learn new technology. There are a bunch of people right now in West Virginia that have their coal job, how much time would it take to transfer coal jobs into wind jobs, and when would wind jobs exceed coal jobs?
Well, the wind jobs in this situation, if it was just the wind farm, it would exceed the total mountain time removal jobs in about 28 years. So about 11 years after the mining would end, the cumulative jobs with the wind farm exceed those that the mountain time removal would provide. But like I said, if that local wind industry were created, if Raleigh County said, hey, we're going to support wind development, you know, because we see a future in it and we see that it's better than even all coal mining that's happening in the county, then it's feasible that a wind manufacturing plant could be sited in Raleigh County. And then from year one, if in that scenario, from year one, wind provides more jobs than mountain time rule
from year
perpetually,
one.
From year number one.
But basically you have to convince some wind manufacturer to come in to Raleigh County.
And how do you do that? You support the development of wind farms.
So
such as on
what is the cost of building a wind turbine facility, and how much of it would a wind manufacturer produce? How much do they want from the government to do that? What kind of resources do they need?
Well, I mean, that all depends on what the state and federal policies are. Like, for example, this wind farm would probably cost around $700 million, but most of that cost would be borne by the developer themselves. Right? It's not like the local communities are going to be.
Well, for example, you mentioned the wind farms that already exist in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Those were all done privately?
It was all private.
Without any government help?
Well, actually, the government, the state government actually moved to make it harder for wind farms to get developed. They increased the business and occupation tax from 5% to 12%, which is good for the state. I mean, you know, on the state level, the wind companies don't have to pay that much. But, you know, it does make... They do go to places where it's more economically
fair. So rather than subsidize wind,
they made it a little bit harder.
They tax wind. They make it harder to do clean energy than to do dirty energy.
Right. But the wind industry is like any other industry. Really, we shouldn't be subsidizing anyone. You know, unless like right now, the coal industry is heavily subsidized from the federal level to the state level.
How is the coal subsidized?
Well, first of all, the federal government, for example, in the new economic stimulus bill, the Senate version of the bill is trying to give away, I think, $4.6 billion to the coal industry. Okay.
Wait, you say give away?
Yes.
Just a pure tax break.
It's part of the stimulus bill.
They don't have to do anything for it. They just get it.
I'm sure some have to do with loans and other issues, but I mean, it's $4.6 billion to an industry that is destroying our environment.
But Obama tells us that the stimulus package is about green energy. How much is going to wind farms?
I believe in terms of the whole green package, there's like $100 billion total. That doesn't mean just wind farms. They've also, I believe each bill includes both a production tax credit and an investment tax credit, which is good because, I mean, the wind industry...
So is it going to all energy equally, or is at least green energy doing better under the stimulus than...
I think both solar and wind, any renewable energy benefits from that one. But here's the difference. So wind energy and solar energy impose a very small, like minuscule, social and environmental cost, especially in relation to coal.
There's virtually no cost, except you might not like the look of the turbines, and a few birds might die.
Right, but who likes the look of smog, or who likes the look of a coal-fired power plant? You know, who likes the look of sludge in their water?
Or a mountain that's been bombed.
Right, or a mountain that's been bombed, exactly. So, I mean, that's really not the issue down here. And you know, there's a smart way to develop wind, but... So two things I'd like to point out is, like I said, the true cost of coal is not being included. And on top of that, the federal government and the state government are giving away tax breaks and subsidies. And so coal is artificially cheap. There was a study, rough study out of, I believe, West Virginia University or Oberlin College or somewhere, that showed that just at a basic level, if you try to include just the health costs related to coal, you know, people with respiratory diseases from power plant pollution, or people... with diseases down in the coal-producing areas from the dust, coal dust or silica in the air or contaminants in the water, that would add an extra 20 cents minimum per kilowatt hour, and nobody would be buying coal electricity. Right now, coal averages like somewhere between 6 and 8 cents per kilowatt hour, right?
That's always true with pollutants. You know, pollutants are cheap only when you don't count what you said, the externalities. When you don't count the fact that someone's got to clean up that pollution, that makes it cheap. It's always cheap. You know, my sewer bill would be very cheap if I could just, go in someone else's yard.
And dump it, right. Exactly.
If I were to dump in their yard, hey, you know, I'd pay no sewer bill.
Right.
No water bill at all. Now, my neighbor would not like it very much, but hey, for me, it's cheap.
Pretty cheap.
Yeah, so that's...
And
that,
I think that's the exact sort of perception that the coal industry has. So,
Yeah, they're dumping in our yard. I know you got a friend here that you wanted to introduce. Why don't you tell me who he is and what he had to do with
Brett here came down to do some
Brett,
awesome
Mark
music.
Hey, Brett, Mark Levine. I'm good. We're live on the radio right now on the Inside Scoop, and I've been interviewing Rory, and he says good things about you.
Yeah, and I want to go and give it over to him so he can talk, because he learned a lot. He came down and stayed with us for about a week, and really was all over the place. I mean, he met all the best locals and hung out with them and learned all the best stories. And one story about Brett is that he was the second day he was there. He had sort of the same paranoia I did, you know, when I first got down there, because it was the coal, you know, it was coal country. And he was walking around.
They were going to come in and bomb you or something.
Well, no, I mean, you know, like I heard about goons, coal goons and all these things, and there is a lot of tension, and like
there's a whole coal mafia, basically.
Well,
you walk home and find like a lump of coal in your bed, kind of.
No, but I mean, like the horse head, but no.
Right.
I mean, I'm not going to say that it's that bad, because really, I mean, there are a lot of people, you know, that sort of misrepresents and stereotypes a lot of things that are, and hides a lot of the true problems and true conflicts that are going on down there. Because a lot of people do depend on the coal industry, right? And a lot of people do believe in coal, and they're proud of their coal history.
And it sounds like in this report, you're suggesting that even a compromise where you continue the underground mining for a little while.
It's a transition.
As a transition to the wind.
Right.
So you're not arguing for end all coal mining now.
Nope.
What you're saying is end the mountain bombing. Keep underground mining as a transition period as you get those wind farms.
Right. And Appalachia has a great potential for developing a whole new green economy. And the sad thing is that their leaders are not supporting them. Their leaders are not saying, hey, let's look at what coal's really doing. Let's look at what the alternatives are. And let's start to develop those. You know, let's stop blowing up the wind resource. Let's stop damaging communities and losing our population. And let's invest in education and infrastructure and health and everything else.
Right.
And Central Appalachia can see a whole new, brand new future. And people could continue to live off their land. You could even have jobs in reclamation. You know, you can have jobs in cleaning up the streams and cleaning up the impacts of the coal industry's past.
Sure, sure.
Those are all new jobs, and they're there, and they're ready to go. And we just need a political will and a whole sea change in the mindset of coal in Central Appalachia. So I want to tell a story about Brett.
Please. Now, Brett, was it you were an intern or something?
No, I forgot the name of your...
I teach environmental science.
Yeah.
Oh, he teaches environmental science. Okay.
What was the name of your website again? That's right, Homegrown Locals.
HomegrownLocals.com. Homegrown Locals. So he came down to work with y'all for a week.
Yeah, and this guy's a badass. He's a kayaker. He's like all over the place, man. He came down and he intensely, like day by day, was there and like with a major intensity, was like learning as much as he could and meeting all the people he could. But it was like one of the first days he was there, he's walking through Whitesville, which used to be this booming coal town, right? And just like all coal towns, when there's a coal bust or when there's an expansion of surface mining, thus less workers, those towns die. And so it's a shell of what it used to be. And people will tell you 8 years ago, I mean, people were out there on Saturday nights. Now you can't see, you can almost hardly find anybody on like a Monday work day, you know, or even a Sunday church day. So Brett's walking through town, and because of all this, you know, this stereotype, and like, just like I said, when I had, he's walking around with a Friends of Coal hat on, just the way he looks like
Uh-oh.
A friendly, right?
Uh-oh.
And I mean, you know, to be honest, that's pretty odd down there anyway, because nobody actually wears a friend of the coal hat. But he was trying to make sure that he didn't, you know, that he could ease in and talk to people, you know, on a local level. And the first guy that brought it up, right? He's like, what are you doing with that friends of coal hat? He's like, oh, no, I'm all about coal. And he could probably tell us more, but then it turned out that the guy he was talking to hated coal.
Oh, okay.
So he was like, oh, actually, I don't care. He like, took it off. And it was all. So
right.
That was one of my favorite stories about Brett. So I'd like to go ahead and let him on, because he...
Sure. I'd like to share that kind of perspective.
Stick
around a little bit, too? Well, I guess we don't have that much time left.
I've got a reception to get to, so...
All right. Well, listen, Rory, I appreciate it. I appreciate your knowledge. You clearly... Let me ask you this, just before I bring Brett on. What can your ordinary listener do? I mean, if you live in West Virginia, that's one thing. We've got listeners throughout the United States. We've got listeners throughout the world on Head On Radio Network. You know, got someone in New York or someone in L.A., what can someone do to help you out, to help protect our resources in West Virginia, throughout the United States, and at the same time, you know, power the United States?
I'll put that as sort of a threefold ask to all the listeners out there. Mountaintop removal is one of the worst things going on in the whole world. I mean, through grad school, I was learning about, you know, extraction issues and its impact on indigenous people in Ecuador with oil, or deforestation in the Amazon. These are all things that are happening in developing countries They're hugely detrimental to the cultures and the environment. And the same thing's happening here in the United States. We shouldn't be doing it anywhere in the world. And the United States should be, you know, should be better than that. Mountaintop Renewal only provides 4% of the nation's electricity right
now. I'm
going
to get you to call this mountain bombing.
Mountain bombing.
One of the things that Republicans taught us, the only thing smart they taught us, is that the way you phrase things count, right?
Yeah.
They changed the estate tax to the
death
tax.
Well, they got it now.
You know, but the difference is this is accurate. It really is mountain bombing. I mean, they're not removing things piece by piece.
Well, imagine this. I think it's over the course of a year. I forgot the time frame, but it's a maximum of a year. Every year in Appalachia, the amount of explosive used to bomb the mountains and completely destroy the culture and the environment there is equal to 58 Hiroshima bombs.
58?
So imagine
nuclear bombs.
Right.
A year?
Atomic bombs. Yep.
A year.
Mm-hmm. Imagine that.
That's impossible to imagine.
Yeah, I know, exactly.
I have a hard time imagining Hiroshima, much less 58 Hiroshima.
You can feel these blasts from up to 5 miles away, easy. Like, we hear them. We hear them just, it seems like it's thundering off my gun. Well, the blasting does, most often the blasting doesn't occur all night.
So it occurs all during the day?
Yeah,
so while
they have blasting times. They'll, like, say, one mine, the Ed White mine, will between 4 and 5, it'll set off anywhere between 1 and 4 blasts. And they're huge, you know, and they rattle people's houses, and they put silica dust into the air, and all that dust comes straight down to the valleys where people live. You know, and it gets in the water, and it kills the trees. Like, it's horrible. So,
and obviously the people know it's happening. The politicians, the West Virginia politicians, have any of them been down there during the explosions? Can you be able to
grab
Jay Rockefeller and say, hey, let me introduce you to my town?
Rockefeller knows what's going on.
But I would love to see a video of him there during the mining, during the explosions, trying to justify it.
He'd probably call it progress. I mean, you never know. Like, he's,
he might.
Yeah, he's Rockefeller.
He might.
So, he's definitely deep into the.
Hey, Rory, I appreciate what you're trying to do.
Well, let me say to your listeners, learn as much about mountaintop removal as you can. It's not needed. It's not necessary in the United States. It's only necessary to maximize profits for the coal companies and the land companies. It only provides 4% of our electricity, and you can learn more. 4%.
That's it.
Electricity. That's right.
Okay.
And over 1 million acres of mountains have been blown up for that. And 1,500 miles of streams, easy.
1,500 miles of streams.
Over 50. It was 1,200 miles as of 2001, and so that doesn't even count the last 7 years. So go to ilovemountains.org, learn what your connection is, learn what you can do, support the Clean Water Protection Act, learn about that. That would help just about put a ban on mountaintop removal. And that's, we had almost 160 co-sponsors in the House before the new session.
Is this a bill that you think will pass the Democratic Congress?
It'll pass the House, but it has to pass the Senate. And right now they're having, because of Senator Robert Byrd, they're having a hard time getting it introduced in the Senate. So.
Interesting. So the problem really is that your two West Virginia senators are...
Yeah, they're not going to let it happen. So.
Are against it.
Yeah, but so there has to be more support.
Well, Byrd isn't going to live too long.
Well, I'm not going to talk about Byrd's health. I mean, to be honest, Byrd has been really important for West Virginia. Unfortunately, he's dropped the ball on protecting communities and really helping new economic opportunities develop. But he has been a great man for the state and has really done a lot.
I just think he's living a bit in the past, maybe as the oldest member of the Senator of the Senate, and doesn't recognize the advantage of new technology.
Right.
Hey, Rory, thanks so much for coming
on. You bet.
And
everybody go to ColeRiverWind.org.
I'm going to bring Brent on here. He's bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, looks raring to go here.
That's a good way to describe him, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
Well, I can see it. I mean, you look at this guy, he's like always smiling, like he's like ready to go. So, have a...